The Clovis First controversy is well known to most alternate history buffs for obvious reasons. I mean, it is a smoking gun for archaeology frequently being just a little bit slow to take on new evidence. But this isn't the only time that the Clovis culture has been at the center of a heated archaeological debate. As a matter of fact, when I was doing research for the Retz Clovis, which according to the museum I saw it in is the largest Clovis point ever found, I was blown away by the numerous parallels between the main talking points in our little community and the history of this artifact. From the amateurs offering better information than the mainstream academics, all the way to the site being closed to future excavations and the site having trees planted on top of it, I was kind of shocked. And what's really crazy about this is the site was closed down to future generations excavating it, basically because of the missteps of one archaeologist who was so certain that he was doing the right thing that you couldn't convince him of otherwise until it was too late. It's a hell of a story here where we talk about the largest Clovis point ever found. Hi, my name's Dan, and welcome to Dedunking. In the 1950s, the Retz Clovis was found in the wheat field up in the mountains of eastern Washington, and it spent about the next 35 years in a shoebox. But apparently the man who found it, Les Ira Kreese, did take it out of the shoebox to show it off from time to time, because in 1990, one of his descendants presented the point to an archaeologist who was working on a newly found site, now known as the East Wenatchee Clovis Site. The archaeologist, Dr. Michael Gramley, recognized the point as having very similar methods of manufacture to the oversized Clovis points that he was finding in this Wenatchee site. Now, since these techniques of manufacture were seen nowhere else in the world except eastern Washington and had only recently been discovered, this basically legitimized the Retz Clovis as a real artifact. I mean, if somebody was going to make a forgery, they wouldn't be using undiscovered techniques that just happened to be discovered decades later, right? But this was even a bigger deal to the collecting community because the Retz Clovis had been discovered before all these repatriation laws had gone into effect. It was not part of this site. It was up for grabs. It was legitimate, and it was the biggest one available. And that mattered a lot because like 23 years after this time, that thing ended up selling for almost $300,000 at auction. Obviously, this is due to its size, right? I mean, the exclusivity of owning the biggest one available is a big deal. There's plenty of Clovis points available, and they don't command remotely the amount of attention or cash that this thing did. But this one did get a lot of collectors coming out of the woodwork, especially when it was posted by the previous owner on the forums. They went to a lot of the collector forums, including TreasureNet, which is the place that you could really see a lot of people having comms about this. We get tons of talk about the speculation of the price. For example, this is a well-documented piece, and the only thing left to discover is how much collectors are willing to pay for it. With another member responding, however blunt, I must agree. There's numerous people speculating on price, with six figures coming up frequently, and then we get comments like, there's plenty of collectors around with that kind of scratch. Pieces like this attract a different kind of collector. These are literally art pieces and also significant pieces of American prehistory. This is the kind of thing that would attract international museums as well as private collectors. There have been several pieces sold this year that have topped the six-figure range. For comparison, there was recently a Picasso sold to a Chinese company for $28.22 million, which was more than twice the auction estimate. When you start getting international art investors and dealers involved, the sky's the limit. That number makes a couple hundred grand look like chicken scratch. Now, this is something I've spoken on at length in my video, Who Hides the Evidence of Ancient Technology? Links in the description. I mean, obviously, collectors are going to pay a lot more for an exclusive piece than a piece that's not exclusive. I shouldn't even have to explain that to most people on a fundamental level, right? But one of the things that's really interesting about this is how the collector forums actually offer more information on the Retz Clovis itself than I was able to find on Google Scholar or any of the other places where academics were putting information. I mean, I would find the occasional mention of the thing, but like who found it, where it was found, how it was legitimized, all that crap I found on collector forums. And that's kind of crazy when you think about it, right? The passionate amateur, there they are. And archaeologists frequently discount the value of these passionate amateurs. But the origins of the field of archaeology itself are people like these collectors. I mean, here's a little cross-section of the origins of the field, of the psychology behind it anyway, right here on this page. You know, people who were so into the pieces that they hoarded that they became experts on the topic. That's how it all started. And this seems to be the case. Look right here. I mean, now of course an experienced flintknapper would be the person most knowledgeable about how the point was made. But the history of the artifact itself is really hard to find. And if not for the collecting community, I wouldn't have a whole lot to say on the provenance of the point. To the academic world, this is an obscure piece, it seems. But to the collecting community, it's so well known that they, 12 years ago, all they needed to know was how much it was going to sell for. We're really lucky, actually, that that previous owner even took it to the forum, so we have the information of them arguing and discussing back and forth the provenance and all that. Otherwise, man, we wouldn't really know much of anything. Had the owner sold this kind of thing before, they might have done a backroom deal or done their research off the grid, and we would have never known any of the stuff that I'm able to talk to you about. I mean, I might have found it on a 10th page of Google Scholar or something, but I sure as heck wasn't finding it when I was doing my research. Of course, I don't go to the 50th page of Google Scholar. I just keep looking for the stuff. Anyway, I didn't find anything from the academic world that was remotely as easy to find or as robust in the information that it provided on this specific artifact as I did from the collecting community on their forums. And that's a little bit crazy to begin with. But we also, I have to thank the owner of the piece. I mean, I saw this damn thing in a museum and they paid a shitload of money. So unless the museum's not mentioning the fact that they're holding a repro there and that's a reproduction and not the real deal, which you think they would have mentioned, I have to thank the owner for putting the thing on loan. I mean, that's a lot of money to just stash in a museum in a little butthole town in Washington. Now, as I mentioned, the Rutz Clovis was first brought to public light in 1990 when excavations at the East Wenatchee Clovis site began in earnest under Dr. Richard M. Gramley of the Buffalo, New York Museum of Science. Gramley had gathered several artifacts from the site, as had Dr. Peter J. Merringer from Washington State University, the first archaeologist to excavate the site. These artifacts were considered very important historically, as there are almost no known Clovis sites in the northwestern United States, and this one looked to be a cache of tools, a very rare find in and of itself. But the site was first found in 1987, and the first excavations began in 1998 under Dr. Merringer, and he wrote about this in the 1988 National Geographic magazine. In the article, he speaks of working with the Colville Confederated Tribe, the indigenous people who have a claim to the site. I consulted with members of the Colville Confederated Tribes about the importance of the site to Native Americans and the respect and thorough scientific treatment it deserved. This was just before the Native American Graves and Repatriation Act and just before Kennewick Man. So the tensions were a little bit less between the archaeological community and the Native American tribes up in the Pacific Northwest in particular. There was actually a fairly decent working relationship. Dr. Merringer was... he was pretty decent at navigating that whole thing and making sure that the tribal people felt that he wasn't going to dishonor them or their religious beliefs in any way, and at the same time he was going to get to do some science. He was an Eastern Washington teacher from the largest Eastern Washington University, WSU, and he was well aware of the potential for bad blood if this was handled incorrectly. And his words illustrate this clearly. He wants to excavate that site, and he knows there's a ton of scientific knowledge to be gained there. But he also knows that he must keep the Colville tribe happy. They cannot feel like this is disrespectful to their ancestors, and he did what he could to alleviate those fears. And it seems to have worked. Dr. Merringer's excavation was unopposed by the Colville tribe, and the 14 artifacts he recovered were treated with respect and used for science. Blood was found on almost every cutting edge of the artifacts that he brought up, which was a big deal. One of them even tested positive for human blood. This was really interesting stuff. But Dr. Gramley was very careful. He mentioned straight up that the possibility for finding graves was high, and that if that happened, that he was going to stop everything that he was doing. He had no intention of defiling Native American ancestral remains. And that was one of the biggest things that allowed him to work with the tribes instead of against them. And since he made sure to let them know that he was interested in tools and weapons and not the bones of their ancestors, they didn't fight his dig. It was just a precursory excavation, but he did determine that they would want to follow up with more excavations. But the follow-up excavation was led by Dr. Gramley from Buffalo, New York, and he was not nearly as concerned with the Colville tribe's opinion on the site. He frequently spoke out against laws that would limit the access of archaeologists to sites like this, and he was certain he was right on things like that, and was basically not very accommodating to Native Americans as far as they were concerned. And this basically created a situation where they protested as soon as he started digging, and it stopped it. It didn't completely stop it, but it created a situation where he had to roll it back a little bit, or he was going to look like the bad guy. So they entered into negotiations and stuff. But they were already complaining about him before it even started. According to the Seattle Times, the Colvilles, who over the years have worked out relatively comfortable relationships with Pacific Northwest archaeologists, are suspicious of Gramley's East Coast connections. He is a curator of anthropology for the Buffalo, New York Museum of Science. People from East Coast tribes tell us scientists back there have a real bad attitude towards Native American people, that Indians are looked at as interfering with their right to dig, said Adeline Fredden, Colville tribal historian. We are told that in the East, human remains are not treated as of any concern to the affected tribe, as we do here in the Pacific Northwest. Fredden said the tribe would be more comfortable if Washington State University, which performed an exploratory dig 2 years ago, were still on the job. Now, in addition to the word-of-mouth warnings that they got from the eastern tribes, the Colville tribe also had the words of Dr. Gramley himself to let them know what potentially could be coming down the pipes. Gramley had said that the Americas are home to a variety of genetically distinct populations. Any or all of these groups could have participated in the peopling of the Americas. Some of these initial immigrants may have left no descendants who survived into the present era. Now, it seems that he made that statement to undermine the idea that Native Americans certainly had claims to any remains that were found at that site. And while that may be scientifically accurate for him to say, it did very little to alleviate the fears of the tribal people, and that really had some bad freaking results overall. Gramley was also chastised for publicizing the site in a collector magazine that regularly mocked the Native American battle for control of their ancestral remains. Matter of fact, according to the Seattle Times, he said some pretty tone-deaf stuff. In an issue of American Artifacts published just before he applied for a state permit for the East Wenatchee dig, he questioned whether collectors should be subject to state laws since artifacts have little bearing upon the health, welfare, and future prosperity of living people. Now, the owner of the land wanted to put a museum there, and this resulted in an argument with Dr. Merringer, and that's why he didn't come back and excavate the site. That's why the owner ended up calling the guys from Buffalo, New York, because this guy, he was a museum curator, and he was good with that stuff, and he was the kind of guy you wanted to come in there and help build a museum. And well, Dr. Merringer, he had worked with the Colville tribe in the past. He was aware of the politics involved, and he knew that that for-profit crap was not going to fly. But nobody listened to him, so he walked away from the whole thing, and they brought in Dr. Gramley, and we ended up with what we got, which was a protest of the second excavation. And it did pressure Gramley into negotiations with the Colville tribe. Now, the tribe had tried to contact Gramley before this, but they had gotten no response. And as a result, the site was placed on a 15-year suspension for excavations as part of their negotiation. That 15 years ended in 2007, but by then the Kennewick Man debate had happened and the situation was vastly different. The Kennewick Man was a high-profile case of the remains that were found in Kennewick, Washington, and it caused quite a controversy because they were about 8,000 years old, and there was a lot of debate over whether or not science should be allowed to use them or whether or not the tribes should be allowed to honor them in their own way without having science mess with it. And it was a big old mess, and it's beyond the scope of this video, but suffice to say that it changed the landscape when it was all said and done. That's what matters here. Because the Colville tribe now controls access to the East Wenatchee Clovis site, period, end of story. And the consensus between both them and archaeologists is the tribe will almost certainly never allow anyone to excavate that site ever again. Now, in a large part, we can blame Dr. Gramley for this. He was the museum expert. He was the guy they brought in to do things right. And he was certain he was doing things right. Matter of fact, he told the Seattle Times, scientists agree, he said, that it's pointless to try to connect any current people, such as the Colville tribes, to remains more than 4,000 years old. I took that as gospel, he said. Obviously, it is not gospel to the Colvilles. No, this is not remotely gospel to the Colville tribe, something Dr. Merringer was acutely aware of, but Dr. Gramley either didn't understand or didn't care. And this is the kind of thing it's actually really easy to see why, if you've ever seen the way an academic or a skeptic or a scientist talks to somebody who's a creationist, you can very much see the deal here. A quote from one of the Colville tribal elders will explain why there's such a disconnect and outright contempt at times. Some people, not all, believe that we came over the land bridge. That is a falsehood, tribal elder and religious leader Moses George said. We grew up here out of the ground. Now, many scientists don't have any respect for a take like that, which is honestly kind of easy to understand. And to be clear, I am of the opinion that once you go back like 5,000 years, man, you really, I think we should be allowed to pretty much excavate anything that's that old. I feel like it's a little bit out there to start claiming remains that are that ancient. However, that's my personal opinion. The law is very different. And thanks to Dr. Gramley, we ain't never going to be able to dig at that site again, because the law gives all the rights to the Colville tribes, and they're that fool me once, shame on me, George W. Bush style, fool somebody and they got fooled or something. But seriously, Dr. Gramley's lack of a concern with optics, with how he looked to the Native Americans, came with consequences for us all. Now, the landowner sold the rights to the site to Washington State, and the legal rights to excavate are controlled by the tribe, so what's happening there now? Well, with something so uncanny, you'll think that I made this up. They planted trees over the site, right? It's an apple orchard there, so just like at Göbekli Tepe, you can't dig into the ground, but you can pick some food and eat it. What's a lot different from Göbekli Tepe, though, is that, well, Jimmy Corsetti's not the one that talked about this site, right? And so we do have an archaeologist on record complaining about the potential damage to the site caused by having trees on top of it. Big surprise. In the 2007 book, Archaeology in Washington, written by archaeologist Richard Daughtry and natural scientist author Ruth Kirk, the following statement can be found. Despite all the care taken, certain risks to the site remain. How will orchard chemicals and irrigation water affect bones still in the ground? And what about ongoing bioturbation, the disturbance caused by roots and rodents? The site in the orchard was essentially undisturbed when its window to the past was opened, albeit slightly. It has been sampled, but not fully excavated. Now, of course, these two authors didn't have to worry about Jimmy Corsetti saying anything about the site, so they weren't like all trying to hedge their bets and make sure they didn't get attacked by other people for tacitly supporting some pseudo-guy. Basically, they were free to say whatever they thought, and this is what they thought. Pretty crazy, huh? But I'm getting off into the weeds a little bit here. The main point I'm trying to make with this is the actions of one single scientist can have extremely massive ramifications for all the rest of us. The appearance to the public is something that Dr. Gramley ignored, and we are all paying for that today. Now, similarly, when archaeologists attack Atlantis wherever they see it, they engage in some really, really bad PR. The optics are horrible. I mean, just like Dr. Gramley said some stuff that maybe was scientifically accurate, but it really looked bad to the Colville tribe. The archaeologists say a lot of things that they feel is really accurate. They're certain this is the way it is, but it looks really, really bad to the pyramidiots out there. And it ends up rubbing us the wrong way, alienating us. Frequently, it's just outright lies, massaging the truth and just character assassination or just some goofy political angle on this whole thing that has nothing to do with the actual conversation at hand. All of these things like end up with like the delegitimization of you guys as individuals and as a body when you engage in this community, and that's bells you can't unring. Just like the Colville tribe ain't letting no archaeologists back there. The Pacific Northwest archaeologists worked their butts off for decades to undo the damage of a 19th century and early 20th century archaeologists, what they had done, the trust they had broken with the tribes. Pacific Northwest archaeologists were trying hard and doing a good job of it. Enter Dr. Gramley. All that's undone, and now nobody gets to go to the site that, you know, before the Pacific Northwest archaeologists were at least wanted there. Nope, they don't even get to go there now. Thanks, Dr. Gramley. This is what you guys can do by being so certain that you're right and you're fighting against Wu. you're fighting against people that think they came from the ground, in the case of the Colville tribe, or that big rocks were brought by aliens or giants lived in the freaking what, all kind, whatever it is, your woo that you disrespect ends up with some really shitty optics, and in some situations ends up damaging future generations immeasurably. So I hope you guys learn from this, but I know that since it's Dan saying these things, it may as well be Jimmy Corsetti saying that we should excavate a site, you're going to find some reason to tell me why we don't need to do it this way. So please tell me down below why we don't need to do it this way. Funnily enough, I stumbled onto this story while I was on vacation this last week. I drove to the coast of Washington State from Spokane, stopped in the channeled scab lands, I took the most scenic mountain pass, drove over the insanely long bridge in Astoria, Oregon. Basically, I wanted to show my 15-year-old son the highlights of the state that he lives in. We camped in Ilwaco, Washington, a tiny town that sits on the mouth of the Columbia River. It was the end of the Lewis and Clark expedition, or at least the ultimate goal that they set out to achieve, so there is a museum dedicated to this right outside of town. In this museum, which covers the military fortification overlooking the Cape, the Lewis and Clark expedition, and the building of the lighthouse, and a few other small things, a section with some Clovis artifacts sits against the wall. In it sits the Rutz Clovis, which sent me down this rabbit hole that led to this video. Which was a little bit unexpected, so I have to say, go out and look at your local museums and the other visitor centers and whatnot. And if you live near the area and feel inclined to go check out the Rutz Clovis, it is at the Cape Disappointment Lewis and Clark Interpretive Center. Now, Ilwaco is gorgeous. It's a quaint little fishing-slash-tourist town. Now, it is on the peninsula, and they don't have as many routes to bring supplies in, so bring stuff like toothpaste and toilet paper with you, because the price of it there is like Rona prices, all right? Now, I found many of the businesses staffed by absolute top-notch people. In particular, Sirius Pizza was very helpful for me to find chicken wings when the rest of the area was out. Now, hey, look, my kid likes chicken wings, okay? I don't know what to tell you. And all they had was a half order left, but they went ahead and sold it to me anyway at a pretty good discount. And all I had to do was ask. And the Cold Pacific Motel was especially helpful because, see, here's the thing. I haven't taken a road trip in quite a while. And I'd forgotten that motels, like, checkout time is 11, check-in time is 3, and I'd scheduled my premiere for 2. So I needed to be in a hotel at 2 o'clock on Sunday to schedule, show my video to the world and be in the chat for you guys to pick on me and scream at me and tell me how much I suck, or not. Thank you. And, well, basically, in order to do that, I had to get a place that had good internet on this little peninsula, which is already a bit of a problem. And I had to find a place that would let me check in early. And a couple of places told me they couldn't do that. But the Cold Pacific, as soon as I said that she was like, oh, yeah, I'll put you right next to the router. I'll have the room ready for you. Does noon work? And I was like, oh, my God. No, I'll be a little later than that. She hooked it right up and took great care of me. And I didn't go around being like, I'm some social media guy that's got some subscribers. And I didn't play any of that this stupid bullshit crap. I just asked and they hooked me up. So if you do end up going down there, get yourself some pizza at Sirius Pizza. Stay at the Cold Pacific Motel. The Cold Pacific in particular, man, that place is clean. It's modern. It's a little small in the rooms, so to be honest with you. But they're modern and clean compared to other things in the region. I was very shocked. And the price was the same as it was everywhere. It was the same at other towns that I'd stayed in that weren't little tourist towns like this. I was expecting it to be about 30%, 40% higher than it was. I was very happy with my experience there. Anyway, I'm done fluffing the business owners there in the Ilwaco region. My point here is there are museums around you that have information and evidence and cool things that you're not thinking of. You might have a Civil War museum that you're going to walk into that's going to have a little Native American section there that may well have some things in that blow your mind. So get out there, touch grass, as the kids say. Touch the museums, too. Thanks a lot for watching. You guys have a great day.